Lecture 7, Old English, the Anglo-Saxon Worldview.
Hello, and welcome back to the world of the Anglo-Saxons. In this lecture, Lecture 7, we're going to spend some time looking at the literary language of Old English, and in particular, at what may be the first poem in the English language, known as Cædmon's Hymn. But before we do that, I'd like to go back to some issues I raised in the previous lecture about vocabulary, about the way in which the Anglo-Saxons coined and borrowed words. Now, in this lecture, let me say that I'm going to be doing a fair amount of reading. I'm going to be giving you lists of words. I'm going to be calling attention to groups of terms that are coined in Old English, that are borrowed from Latin during different periods, and I'm going to read aloud. I'm going to read aloud Cædmon's Hymn and talk about it in some detail. Now, let me return to where I left off in the last lecture. Latin words are borrowed, broadly speaking, into the Germanic languages in two periods. The continental period, which is the period before Old English splits off, before the Anglo-Saxons settle on the British Isles. The continental period when the words are borrowed into the group of Germanic languages. And most Germanic languages share words borrowed in the continental period. Words like street that I mentioned last time. Words for war like camp or wall or mile or pit. All words for warfare. Words for trade. The Latin word capo, referring to a small tradesman, gave us our word cheap, which originally means an exchange, East Cheap or Cheapside. London street names were mercantile streets. Good cheap was a good bargain or a good price. Eventually, the word cheap just came to mean something that was inexpensive or a good deal. Words for wine, because the Romans were great vintners. Words like pound or mint for money, for weighing. Words for food, foodstuffs that the Romans gave to the Anglo-Saxons, like fermented milk, cheese, pepper, butter, or particular vegetables and fruits, peas, plums, and prunes. Words for architecture, chalk, copper, pitch, and tile. And words for rulership. The Latin word Caesar, the name Caesar, gave not just to English but to many European languages, a word for absolute rulership. In German, Kaiser, and in Russian, Tsar. These are both borrowings and transmutations of the Latin name Caesar. After the Anglo-Saxon peoples settled in the British Isles, the period of insular borrowing began, the period when words were now being borrowed from Latin speakers and traditions who already were in the British Isles. Now, England had a Christian community of some form or another from about the late 2nd to the beginning of the 3rd century. And in the 4th century, when Christianity becomes, with Emperor Constantine, the official religion of the Roman Empire, Latin Christianity in the British Isles brings into the linguistic mix a whole set of terms for particular forms of ecclesiastical control and ecclesiastical life. Thus, you have words like cross, priest, shrine, rule, school, master, and pupil that are borrowed from the old Christian Celtic Latin, that mix of Roman and Celtic of the early centuries AD that is already in motion when the Anglo-Saxon peoples settle. But there were also periods of borrowing, not just from Latin, but from other Germanic languages. The Anglo-Saxons came in contact with other Germanic peoples, and in particular, the Scandinavian peoples. Throughout Anglo-Saxon history, especially in the 8th and 9th centuries, England was subject to raids, incursions, and settlements by Vikings and Danes, by Scandinavians who came either to plunder or to live. Now, it's very interesting to see some differences here. I've spent a lot of time talking about sound changes and sound differences, and here's another set of them. The Germanic languages had words in common, but the Scandinavian languages pronounced those words differently from Old English. Or to put it another way, there are sound relationships inside the Germanic languages, as well as between the Germanic languages and the non-Germanic languages. The best examples I can give are the following. Words in English, in Anglo-Saxon, that began with the SH sound, or that had the SH sound in them, sh, corresponded to words in the Scandinavian languages that had the SK sound in them. Thus, you had a word like shirt in English, which was skirt in the Scandinavian languages. Or a word like ship would be the word skip in the Scandinavian languages. Now, what's interesting here is how these words have survived, both the Old English and the Scandinavian form. Dialect and regional differences between the North and the South changed the texture of the language. Most of the Scandinavians settled in the North and in the East of England. And so, when you have a word like ship, you also have a word skip, which survives as our word for someone who runs a ship, a skipper. A word like shirt corresponds to a word like skirt. It's an article of clothing. It's just a different article of clothing. Similarly, CH sounds in the South and in Old English corresponded to K sounds in the Scandinavian languages. Church becomes Kirk. And this is very clear in people's names and in towns. Or the suffix which, pronounced without the W now, like Norwich or Harwich, in the Scandinavian settled communities, this ending would have been vik or wick. The CH would have corresponded to a K sound. So you have Harwich, Norwich, Ipswich, but you have Berwick upon Tweed. Now you could go to a map of England and you could underline all the towns that end in which and all the towns that end in vik or wick. And then you would find, as it were, a kind of line, like an isobar on a weather map. And that line would be your line of settlement or incursion, the difference between Scandinavian-speaking peoples and Anglo-Saxon-speaking peoples. And you can do this for many kinds of town names. Burg in Anglo-Saxon is B, B-Y. And so instead of a burg in the North, you have a town like Whitby. And you can chart this out to give you geographical boundaries that correspond to linguistic lines. Scandinavian Germanic languages had a whole set of distinctive sounds. Muggy, ill, ugly, egg, rugged. These are the sounds of Scandinavian, and they pass into the English language in the large. Words from learned Latin were also borrowed later in the 10th and 11th centuries. And so in addition to the early Latin words, in addition to the Scandinavian words, you now have, for the insular period, another level of Latin borrowing. Words of great learning, polysyllabic words, words of arcana, words like antichrist or apostle or canticle, demon, font, nocturne, Sabbath, synagogue, accent, history, and paper. But as I've said in other lectures, Old English and the Germanic languages did not simply borrow words. In fact, they often resisted borrowing words. And they loved to coin their own words as calques or as new forms that translated, in effect, other concepts. Old English made new words in four ways. What we call determinative compounding. Now, that's a very technical term for simply a way of yoking together two normally independent nouns. Earring. Earring. That's an Old English word. Bookstaff is the Old English word. Bookstaff for letter. You could also compound by putting an adjective and a noun. Midanyard, the middle yard, the place where we live, or the earth. Featherholma, a feather coat, a home of feathers, plumage of a bird. My favorite, bonlocken, bone locker. That's your body. Your body is your bone locker. These are part and parcel of the poetic vocabulary. In addition to determinative compounding, there's repetitive compounding, where you have words that are very nearly identical brought together for a particular effect. Holt voodoo. Now, that's Old English for wood wood. The two words just mean wood, wood wood. Now, a wood wood or a holt voodoo would be a place where there was a lot of wood, like a forest. So, a holt voodoo is a forest. Gangelwevra, the going about moving one. This in Old English is the word for spider, interestingly enough. Flutterbee, a flutterby. This becomes mispronounced and transposed into English, modern English, butterfly. There's nothing buttery about a butterfly. It's a flutterby. There are also third noun adjective formations. Grass green. Lofjorn, praise eager. Goldgroden, which means gold adorned. In modern English, we still have this. For example, fighter bomber, king emperor. This kind of yoking together of words like that. And of course, fourth, prefix formations. Old English, as modern English does, has lots of prefixes. Be as a prefix. Come, to arrive. To become, to arrive into something else. Where, to be careful. Beware, be extra careful. After, or and. And as a prefix means not and, as the couple of today, but back. Swear, swearian, the Old English word to speak, or to swear, or to give an oath. Answerian, answer, to give an oath back, in some sense. The Old English word with doesn't mean with, it means against. Stand, withstand, is to stand against, not to stand with. And so these kinds of prefixes change the vocabulary, they add to the possibilities of the language, and they make it possible for writers and readers to, as it were, enhance the verbal resources through which they would describe the world. Many of these verbal resources are pressed into the service of a literary and a poetic language. And as I mentioned earlier, Old English poetic language is primarily nominal. That is, it uses synonyms to create structures of meaning. It hinges on repetition and restatement. And when we look at early English poetry, we're very often looking at poems which develop clusters of synonyms. Structurally, Old English poetry is alliterative. Now, what do I mean by that? Alliteration is the repetition of an initial consonant or vowel sound. Old English poetry, as Old Germanic poetry was, operated by a principle of alliteration. In other words, what made a poem, or what made a poetic line metrical, was not the number of syllables in the line, and not whether or not it rhymed with another line, but how many alliterating stressed syllables it had. This is the bedrock of early English and early Germanic poetry. Repetition, alliteration. Also, it is believed that Old English poetry was composed orally. That is, it may have been written down, but it was built up, some have argued, much like Homer's verse, out of formulae, out of little bits and pieces. A formula in Homer is an epithet. Cow-eyed Penelope, the wine-dark sea, wily Odysseus. These are formulae, you can just fit them in. Similarly, Old English had lots and lots of formulae, lots of little bits of verse that could be plugged in to alliterate, to make the line scan, and to enhance the flavor or the texture of the verse. Late in the 7th century, a cowherd named Cadman seems to have had a vision. In Bede's ecclesiastical history of the English church and people, we are told that one day Cadman, the cowherd, could not participate in the group entertainment of his peers. The harp would be passed, the mead would be drunk, and Cadman would be embarrassed. And he went off by himself, and he went into the cowshed. And an angel came to him, and an angel said, "Why don't you sing for me, Cadman?" And Cadman said, "I cannot sing." And the angel said, "But you can sing." And Cadman said, and here I read the translation of Bede's Ecclesiastical History, made in the 10th century under the aegis of King Alfred. Cadman said, "What shall ich singan?" Pure old English, but pure modern English too. "What shall I sing?" And the angel said, "Sing me frumschaft." Sing me about creation. And so Cadman sang. And what he sang is, as far as we can tell, the earliest recorded English poem. And it goes like this. Nu schulan herian, Herr von Riches Wert, mehr to des Mächte and his mode ye thank, werk wulder fader, swahi wundre ye wes, eche drichten, or anstelde. He erest shop, erven bernum, helfen to grove, halig shippend, tha midanjerd, monkinis weard, eche drichten, after Theoda, firm foldan, Freya elmichtig. In modern English, now we shall praise heaven kingdom's guardian, the creator's might and his heart thought, the works of the glory father, how he established the beginning of each of the wonders of the eternal Lord. He first shaped for earth's children heaven as a roof, this holy creator. And then a middle yard did mankind's guardian, the eternal Lord, prepare afterwards for the men of the earth, the Lord Almighty. What kind of poem is this? How does it work? What does it say? How does it teach us something about Old English language, literature, and life? Let's look at the very beginning. Close your eyes and imagine hearing this poem in the oral way that Cadman would have delivered it. Nu schulan herian, now let us praise Heofenrichus Weird, the Weird, the guardian, the warden, literally, ward, of Heofenrichus, of the kingdom of heaven. Metodus Mechta, the might of the Metode. God is now not just a lord or a warden or a guardian, but he is metode, from the word meten, to mete out, the idea of God as a gift giver, as a measure of judgment. And his mode ye thunk. Mode is our word mood, state of mind. Ye thunk, his thoughts, the thoughts in his mind, the work of the Wuldor Fader. A coinage, Wuldor Fader, father of Wuldor, Old English for glory. What kind of lord is he? Echa drichten. Drichten is the Old English word for a temporal lord, not the supreme being. But Cadman uses it here to create an image of God, as it were, on an analogy to temporal or political lordship. What did God do? He erest shop. He first created. Now this word shop, shelp, is our word shape. The word shop is the word for poet or scop in Old English. The poet is a shaper, but God is also a shaper. He is the holy shippend. He is the shaper, the creator. But what does he create? He creates the mid-on-yard, the middle yard, Middle Earth, the warden for mankind, this eternal Lord, and he also is now Freya Almishtig. He is Freya. Freya is an Old Norse god. And the word Freya here comes from that Old Norse word meaning excellence or bloom, as in a river. As in a ruler. God creates heaven and earth as if he were roofing heaven. Hefen to Hrofa. Now, we can understand this in many ways, but we can also understand this, I think, not just linguistically, but mythologically. In the Old Norse sagas, the Old Norse poems, the story of creation is the story of the building of Asgard by the gods. And Valhalla, the Hall of the Dead, is built by a great artificer. And now I'm going to quote just from a translation of the Old Norse Edda. An artificer came there and offered to build them a stronghold so good that it should be staunch and secure against the giants and the ogres. And that Valhalla, that Hall of the Dead, had a great roof. Now, take these bits and pieces and see what Cadman is doing. Sing me Frumshaft. Sing me about creation. What kind of creation do we get from an Anglo-Saxon poet in the late 7th century? We get a creation that is modeled in many ways on older Germanic creation myths, on a language of Old Norse heroism, on a language of Old English political fealty, on a language that depends constantly on renaming God. Weard, Method, Wulderfader, Drichten, Schippen, Weard, Freya. What does this poem say? One of the things it says is that there are many names for God, but of course only one God. Or to put it another way, Cadman is translating for a newly Christianized audience the idea of a single paternal God. And he's doing so by giving them familiar words. God is like a this. God is like a that. If you are familiar with them, then you know what God is. And it's as if Cadman is in effect saying, well, if you don't think of God in this way, think of God in this way. Each of these synonyms is a kind of option for understanding. This is a poetry too, as I hope you heard, that alliterates. Hafen to Hrofa, heaven to roof. Midanjerd, Monkinus, Meertes, Mechta, and his Modjathank. You have to hear the alliteration, because you have to hear it as a poetry of rhythm. This is a poem that emerges out of a story of singing. It's a poem that emerges out of a tale of the harp. It's a poem that translates Christian concepts not only into the language of the Anglo-Saxons, but into the social occasion of Anglo-Saxon society. And this sense of Cadman's hymn as perhaps the first English poem is important for us because it shows us whether or not it is the first Old English poem. That at its origin, Old English poetry is in many ways about origins, about creation. Let me put it another way. Let's say it's not so much whether Cadman's hymn is or is not the first English poem. It's that we want it to be the first English poem. And certainly Bede, who wrote this story down in the early 8th century, wants it to be the first Old English poem. Bede's ecclesiastical history is written in Latin, and later on it's translated into the West Saxon dialect of King Alfred. But Cadman's hymn is in Northumbrian, because Cadman, like Bede, was in Northumbria. Where do we read Cadman's hymn in its original dialect? We do not read it in the text that I read you just now, from a translation of the 10th century. Rather, we read Cadman's hymn in its original, in the margins of medieval manuscripts. Bede's Ecclesiastical History, written in Latin, has Cadman's hymn in Latin. And Bede says, in effect, I've tried to translate this, not word for word, but sense for sense. And you all understand how difficult it is to translate. And then, some scribes have written in the margins of this Latin manuscript, in several copies of these manuscripts, Cadman's hymn, in the margin. The first English poem, if it is the first English poem, survives in its original dialect as a piece of scribal marginalia. Let's go back and review some of the issues of dialect and culture and language that I've been talking about. We can see now that for the West Saxons of Alfred's period, the idea of a regional dialect as a standard not only translates, but almost effaces that which has gone before. Paradoxically, the first poem of the English language survives in its original form in marginalia. It survives in West Saxon as part and parcel of the story of Cadman as translated from Bede's history. When we see how Cadman translates Christian concepts into Old English verse, when we see how he uses this oral, formulaic, alliterative verse to express Christian ideas, and when we see how his poem illustrates the principles of Old English word formation and compounding and synonymy, when we see all these things, we may admire the craft or the imagination of this bardic cowherd. But when we see the texts themselves, and we see how Cadman's hymn has been reshaped into a language I've just read you, a standard, perhaps, of Old English, we're also taken back to one of the first questions I asked in this course of lectures. What is a standard, and how do we judge it? What is canonical about English literature? What makes certain works of literature worth reading? How do we create a system of literature that gives us texts of lasting aesthetic or spiritual or cultural value? I would like to suggest, and I will suggest throughout this course, that answers to those kinds of questions are also answers about the history of the English language. What makes literature canonical in many ways is the language that it's phrased in, the way in which a canonical, official, or standard dialect takes a text from far away and makes it something close to home. In subsequent lectures, we will see how English poets transform the verbal resources of their language and translate the inherited resources of learning and experience into palpable texts and expressions of felt experience. In Cadman, we can see, not only in its origin, but in its transmission, the making of an English poetry and the making of an English language unique and special to it. Thank you.